Cahoon versus the Commonwealth. Council had an opportunity to sign the signing sheets.
Yes, sir.
Council, whenever you're ready.
And if I can reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Thank you. Good morning, I'm Jenna Knott. I'm with the Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Wayne Cahoon in this case. He was convicted in Spotsylvania of possession with intent to distribute a controlled substance and conspiracy to of the same charge. We challenge sufficiency of the evidence for both cases. This case is a little bit confusing because there's two different drugs. There's oxycodone and there's morphine, and there's two different Cahoons. There's Wayne and there's Roy. I represent Wayne. His brother was Roy.
Either the morphine or the oxycodone would be a Schedule 1 or 2 controlled substance
sufficient
to support the conviction, assuming everything else was proven.
Correct. In regards to, I believe the main argument by the Commonwealth at trial and also in the Commonwealth's brief was in regards to the oxycodone, but you're correct, either could have affirmed a conviction. In regards to the oxycodone, I believe there's an issue in possession. The Commonwealth argued in their brief that it could be constructive or joint possession, but in this case, we had actual possession. Roy had actual possession, not Wayne, my client. The oxycodone was found in Roy's pocket. There was no evidence that Wayne knew that Roy had the oxycodone.
But there's no dispute that Wayne possessed the morphine.
Correct. It was Wayne's morphine. It was his prescription. However, in that case, there's no evidence that he had intent to distribute the leftover morphine that was in the bottle.
Do you agree that at a minimum he's guilty of possession of the morphine?
I believe he had possession. I don't believe he's guilty of it because it's a legal prescription.
All right. But at a minimum he's in possession of that.
Yes.
And
yes.
That would support the indictment. That is evident. Not the intent to distribute. It would support the possession element in the indictment.
Yes, he has possession element of morphine. Again, it was a legal prescription, so it's not a legal possession of morphine. However, with the intent
to distribute. Depends what he intends to do with it.
Correct. I think that the evidence didn't show that he had intent to distribute the morphine that he actually had possession of. What the law has said is that the intent has to be coupled with the possession. It has to be contemporaneous. Even if, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth and taking all the reasonable inferences, the court decided that whatever pills were missing in that vial, and again, the morphine was filled 4 days before, the oxy was filled the same day.
But there is expert testimony that number of pills being missing was inconsistent with personal use.
It was inconsistent with personal use that he would have taken that many in one day. However, he had 4 days that he could have done who knows what with it. But I'm saying even if you believe that he distributed the missing pills, you can't say that the leftover pills which he possessed in Spotsylvania were doomed for distribution. What the expert also said is that people who use drugs and sell them often have their own prescriptions and they sell some and they use some.
What about the note in the wallet? And I recognize it references oxy and not the morphine.
Exactly. The note in the wallet has
Doesn't it significantly suggest he is involved in the illegal prescription drug trade in Spotsylvania, given that he has a piece of paper that has written on it street value, and I can come up with no reasonable explanation for that other than somebody's engaged in the street sale of prescription drugs?
Even if you believe that, one, you don't know that happened in Spotsylvania. In your question, you said the illegal distribution in Spotsylvania.
Who knows? Well, it matches up with the testimony that the street value of the drug in Spotsylvania matched the amounts on that form.
In Spotsylvania, it does. There wasn't evidence that it didn't match the street value of oxy anywhere else, as well as $1 per milligram. There's no evidence that that isn't the same anywhere else. And again, even if you believe that that note referenced some sale of oxy, because we know it wasn't this oxy, because the quantity was different and the milligrams were different, even if that note references some oxy distribution at some other time, that still does not mean that the oxy that Roy had, because Wayne never had any oxy, the oxy that Roy had left over, which was his valid legal prescription, those number of pills were doomed for distribution. Again, it's the same argument that he very well could have sold some at some point. No evidence that it was in Spotsylvania or when it occurred, and the rest was for his personal use. There's no evidence to contradict that, and I don't believe that the Commonwealth proved their case. Again, the major point is that the intent has to be coupled with these pills. The Commonwealth, in their brief, has made a number of...
If we conclude that there was sufficient evidence to support the conviction for possession with an intent of a Schedule 1 or Schedule 2, do you concede that your argument regarding conspiracy fails?
No. With a conspiracy, there has to be an agreement. In a previous case, this was Foster, I believe, it said that the agreement is the essence of the conspiracy. There's no evidence of an agreement in this case. Again, if you want to talk about the morphine, there's no evidence that Roy knew anything about Wayne's morphine. So really, the argument comes down to the oxycodone, because that's the only thing the two have in common. Roy has the oxycodone on his person. Wayne has this note referencing oxycodone, which, again, I would point out, it can't be the same oxycodone. And I think that's the big difference.
But it doesn't necessarily need to be the same oxycodone. It could be a suggestion that he is in the industry of distributing oxycodone because he has this information on his birth.
I'm not saying the note is completely irrelevant. I think it's relevant to consider, but I don't think
it's incriminatory, though, isn't it?
It doesn't help Wayne. I'm not saying it does, but I'm saying that for a conspiracy for intent to distribute, I think that the conspiracy has to be about those drugs. It can't be about some drugs in the past that they had some conspiracy.
How about the fact that it's only 2 hours since they picked up the oxycodone and 50 pills are missing?
And I would disagree that they picked it up. There's no evidence that Wayne ever went to, the drugs were filled in Fairfax, yes, approximately 2 hours earlier. There's no evidence that Wayne was there. There's evidence that Wayne was in Spotsylvania with Roy. The Commonwealth says that you should infer that they went up together, but the facts don't support that. This wasn't their car. Well, neither of them had a license.
Suggesting driving the car probably wasn't the best idea, but what is the trier of fact allowed to do with the fact that Wayne gave conflicting, contradictory statements about the missing morphine?
Against the missing morphine, so that, I guess, so we're getting away from conspiracy because the morphine doesn't really, Roy had nothing to do with the conspiracy of the morphine. So if you're going back to the possession with intent to distribute the morphine, then I think that if you look at the facts, you can't infer that he gave completely conflicting statements because the Commonwealth's own witness...
I assume I disagree with you.
Okay. Then, again, if you think he was lying about what he did with the other pills, you can believe that he distributed those. You can believe that. No evidence that happened in Spotsylvania, and no evidence of the day that happened. That doesn't equate to evidence that his legally prescribed morphine that was left over was doomed for distribution.
Let me ask you about that question, because I'm having trouble with this. The 18.2-250, the possession statute, talks about unless it's possessed pursuant to a valid prescription. You said legal prescription. All we have here is a pill bottle with the defendant's name on it that indicates that it's been dispensed from a doctor. And yet we've got two guys from, Pennsylvania?
No, that wasn't ever proven where they were from.
They weren't from Fairfax, were they?
They were not from, that wasn't proven either where they were from.
I thought there was some evidence that they were traveling through.
There was at least a Massachusetts ID card.
Roy had a Massachusetts ID card, yes. My client had a Virginia ID card.
And we've got a large amount of drugs. I mean, given the prescription dosage, it just would have lasted some period of time. What evidence is there that this, whatever prescription that was filled by this doctor was a valid prescription, was a lawful prescription, as opposed to a pill doc up there just writing script left and right?
I don't think that you can assume that that's what happened when no evidence was presented of
but
that.
But the burden's on the defendant to establish the negative, or to prove validity of the prescription.
I don't believe it is. I don't believe it's on us to prove that a prescription, which is in a not contested prescription bottle that contains the pills that are supposed to be in that bottle, I don't think it's our burden to go the extra step and track down the doctor and who wrote that prescription to verify it's a valid prescription when it was never contested by the Commonwealth whether or not it was a valid prescription.
Is it your position, position that although it was in the car being driven by your client because the notebook had Roy's name on it and not Wayne's, that we can't tie Wayne, that the facts don't tie Wayne to the notebook in any way, shape, or form?
Yes, I don't think there was any facts that Wayne even knew that a notebook was there. Detective Friedman testified that it was inside a bag in the trunk, and so they never asked Wayne about the notebook. There was no evidence that Wayne even knew the notebook existed. Again, I think that when you're looking at, when we're talking about if they went up to Fairfax together, to bring up your point, I don't think that there is evidence of that. Like I said, this wasn't either one of their cars. Neither of them had a driver's license. And that's when you look at the Commonwealth's statement in their brief, and they said that it must have been Wayne because Roy didn't have a car or a license. Well, neither did Wayne. And so I don't think you can say who went up to Fairfax when they met up. That evidence just isn't in the record.
I want to take you back to the question. It took me a minute to find this statute because it's been around a while. But 18-point, I'm just talking about the validity of the prescription and therefore the validity of the lawfulness of the possession. 8.2-263 says, in any complaint, information, or indictment, any action proceeding brought for the enforcement of provisions of the Drug Control Act or this section, it shall not be necessary to negative any exception, excuse, proviso, or exemption contained in this article, and the burden of proof in any such exception, excuse, proviso, or exemption shall be on the defendant. So the defendant has the burden of establishing that his possession of these drugs is pursuant to a lawful prescription, and he didn't do that.
I think that he did. When it's a valid, there was no concession, there was no argument that the prescription bottle was in any way forged or that he at any time had an invalid prescription. They even showed some of Roy's prescriptions. That was admitted in the evidence.
I don't disagree with you that somebody wrote a prescription, but there's a lot of evidence to me in this case that whoever wrote this prescription did not do it based on medical need.
Well, and honestly, that would be on the doctor. You then have to go the extra step to prove that if the doctor wrote what in the doctor's own standard would be an illegal prescription, then you'd have to prove that Wayne had knowledge that that was an illegal prescription when he went and filled it, and then therefore had illegal drugs.
Making reference to the statute, it appears that that statute makes it an affirmative defense, thereby requiring the defendant to prove that it was indeed a legal prescription. And in this case, there wasn't any evidence to support that affirmative defense.
But I don't think there was evidence to support that he wasn't charged with an illegal possession of drugs. He wasn't. That's why no evidence was presented, because that was never an argument that we had to make, because there was never challenged that these prescriptions were illegal. I think I'm going to get into my rebuttal time, so if there are any more questions.
Mr. Blanton.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Blanton on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Let me get to the thing that's on my mind right now, and I know this might take you out of the sequence of your argument, but I need to get to this because I'm struggling with this. Let's focus on this conspiracy charge.
All right.
And the case law that kind of gets me confused a little bit is the difference between an aider and an abettor and a person who's part of a conspiracy. And for a point of reference, let me read some of the case law so you can answer my question better. Defendant may willingly aid a criminal act and be liable as an aider and abettor, but not be liable for a conspiracy which requires knowledge of and voluntary participation in an agreement to do an illegal act. In order to establish the existence of a conspiracy as opposed to mere aiding and abetting, the Commonwealth must prove, quote, the additional element of pre-concert and connivance not necessarily inherent in the mere joint activity common to aiding and abetting. As the way I read that, just simply being around may get you an aider and abettor, but to get to a conspiracy, you need something significantly more.
And I think we have those cases that were cited in the defendant's brief, and I'm not able to pull the name out right off my what we had, the O sheet with two different handwritings, that wasn't sufficient. But I think what you have to do in these cases, excuse me, very froggy this morning, is to look at the totality of the circumstances. And I think addressing one issue that Judge Petty was raising, it's not in the appendix. I glanced quickly, but somewhere in the records, and I think they're part of the records of the whole of the whole proceedings, is the fact that Mr. Cahoon, the defendant, Wayne Cahoon, had an address in Spotsylvania County. His brother clearly had come down from Massachusetts with the it was his ID. That gave him his address and residence as Massachusetts. He was down with his brother for whatever reason. We know that Wayne Cahoon was driving a local resident's car, apparently with permission. It's a reasonable assumption that Wayne got permission to drive that car. Roy had no car. There's no evidence that Roy had a car. Neither one of these gentlemen had a driver's license. So how did Roy get up to Fairfax? 2 hours ago. He's still driving in a car. He's riding in a car driven by Wayne. Wayne drove him up to Fairfax. I think that's a reasonable inference from these facts. He drove him up to the doctor. He drove him to the prescription, to the pharmacy, excuse me, got the prescription filled. 2 hours later, there are 50 pills missing. Wayne is the driver.
Where's the hook, the connivance, and pre-concert?
You go back to the note in Wayne's pocket talking about street prices for prescription oxycodone at $1 a milligram, whether it's 80 milligram pills, 30 milligram pills, or in this case, 15 milligram pills. That means those pills that Roy possessed were going at 50. Wayne is driving him from spot to spot, and there's a case, and I apologize, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but it was the girlfriend driving the defendant on separate occasions to deliver drugs at a location. They were guilty of conspiracy there, and that's in the defendant's brief, and I will see if I can find that very quickly for you, Your Honor.
The Woodley and Sicilis case?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And I think that goes right to it. He's driving him all over the county distributing those.
The evidence in those cases, as I read them, is substantially more than the evidence in this case.
Well, it is clearly circumstantial evidence. Okay. And I think when you just keep building it up, the note paper, and I would like to point out, if you read that note paper in full, I don't know what Wayne Cahoon's business was, and it's not clear, but it established the fact that this is a guy who's short of money.
But Judge Petty used a pretty good analogy yesterday. Actually, I'll be better than that. He used an excellent analogy yesterday because I like Judge Petty. And he talked about going down a football field. He talked about, you know, reasonable articulable suspicion maybe being inside the 10-yard line, that's the way I interpret it. And once you get into the outside the 50-yard line, you're in the scoring zone. And then once you get to beyond a reasonable doubt, you're in the red zone. I think that there probably would have been enough maybe for reasonable articulable suspicion, maybe probable cause. But how do we get beyond a reasonable doubt in a conspiracy case from those facts?
I think you've got Wayne driving Roy where 50 pills have been distributed. I think that's more than aiding and abetting. You've got Wayne, who has the information on oxycodone, and if you read that sheet, advice on new house and how to save money due to faulty construction and cheaper material. And he lists plywood not used, used OSB, and I don't know what that is. Trusses used instead of cutting rafters. Huge saving. Saved approximately $8,000 or so, I was told. Here's a man who's cutting corners, whether it's having his own house built or whether he's actually in construction and buildings, he needs money. He's cutting corners on either his house or somebody's house that he's building.
I'll venture a guess if I go out and stop anybody on the street and ask them, would they like a couple extra $1,000, they'll say yes. So I don't know how much that gets you.
But you tie it in with the oxycodone, where you've got, in this case, it's $3,300 worth of oxycodone on the street in Roy's possession. And you've got the O sheet in the book, whether it's in the trunk or not, it's still there. And you've got the detective saying, all of this is inconsistent with personal use. And it goes back to both the possession with intent and to the conspiracy. I think it all wraps up. They were out driving around distributing those pills that night.
Mr. Black, let me ask you this. There were a number of prescriptions that were found, I assume unfilled prescriptions.
Yes, sir. They were
in the
dated
name of
later.
Roy Calhoun. And this dealt with clozapram. What is that? That's Xanax or
I think that's right, but I'm
sorry. methadone, which is a heroin substitute. Roxycodone. I don't.
It looks like it's the same thing because it's 15 milligrams, 225.
In any event, all of these prescriptions were written by Dr. Nassar Ghazini. Is there? I don't have the prescription bottles in the appendix. Do you know whether the prescriptions found in Wayne's possession were written by that same doctor?
I have no idea. I sort of assume they were because they were all written. I think, yeah, they were written on that 11/23 day.
Well, if they were, and I guess we'll have to check the actual record, because maybe I don't even know that they were sent to us because
I don't think they were.
We have slip sheets.
We have a slip sheet in it. But anyway, just assuming for argument's sake that they were written by the same doctor, wouldn't that indicate some concert of action between the two defendants?
That's part of my point, is the fact that he drove it. Wayne has the vehicle from a local resident that Deputy Frieden recognized from various contacts with him. Clearly, Wayne's borrowed the car. Wayne is the local person. Wayne has the car. Wayne's driving it.
Either these are two of the most pain-racked, neurotic individuals in the world, or they're up to something.
Well, and unfortunately, the detective said that he didn't find anything. He did not consider those prescriptions when he gave his opinion that considering all the evidence, the note, the O-sheet, the lack of the missing 40 morphine pills, the missing 50 oxycodone pills, the fact that both defendants said, I consumed them, I think it's pretty clear that they both knew what they were doing. There was both something going, they both were doing this together. And I don't think there's any question that they conspired to do it. You just have to look, and I know it's circumstantial evidence, but it's perfectly valid evidence, and you just build on those circumstances. Wayne is out driving Roy around with somebody else's car. Clearly, Wayne is the local person. He has the contact.
So you would essentially default to a standard of review here. That is whether a reasonable fact finder could conclude based upon all these circumstances that you're suggesting to find the defendant guilty of.
I think all these circumstances pile on and pile on and pile on. And, you know, whether you've got to go back to your football, to Judge Petty's football analogy, whether you have Walter Payton running who could run over a lot of people, you get enough circumstances piled on him, you get enough defenders piled on him, he's going down. And I love watching Walter Payton run. But enough people could tackle him all at once. And I think you've got a situation here where the circumstances piled up and no reasonable judge could.
You know, just one note. I was glancing again at the appendix that we've been talking about where everybody is from. I think there's a comment by the defense attorney after the conviction. Ms. Knock, I believe, says, Your Honor, the Calhouns have been free on bond. They actually live up in Massachusetts and have been going up there and coming back to court. So there is some indication in the record as to where these people are from, where the two defendants are from. That's on page...
Yes, sir, I see it, 194.
194.
And as I said, I believe if you look in the full record with the warrant for arrest, I believe Mr. Calhoun also had an address in Spotsylvania. And it's not in the opinion.
Your opponent probably is going to say that that's a dual domicile, so that can be explained.
But he's the one who's got a residence in Virginia. He's the one who's got a residence where this car is known, the owner of the car is known to be. So the presumption I think that's fair to make is that he knew the owner of the car. He asked for permission to borrow the car. We have no evidence that Roy had a car. And I know the defense has made an argument about whether or not Wayne Calhoun made two true statements. Then they've made an argument about whether or not the deputy, what the nature of the question was. And I just point your attention to page 113 in the appendix. Okay, it starts at the top there and says, okay, do you remember exactly the question that you asked both times? No, but the content of it was, you're missing these pills. What happened to them? I think clearly the question was, where are the missing 50 morphine pills? And one time he said they're at home. One time he said, I consumed them. And I think the fact finder is allowed to take that and use it as evidence of his guilt.
He's allowed to believe that it was incredible that they had consumed that many pills, that they were lying, and that he can draw the inference that they were lying in order to conceal the guilt.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we would urge the court to affirm these convictions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Blatt. If not,
it's not in the record. Perhaps you know we can. Well, I mean, it's not in the appendix, but we can check the record. Were the morphine pills prescribed by Dr. Nazagini?
I honestly don't remember, but I think there was something I need to clear up. Wayne's pills were not filled on that day. Wayne's pills were filled on the 19th. I honestly don't remember if it was the same doctor or not, but these were not pills that were filled on the same day.
If it was the same doctor, would that be some incriminating circumstances the trial court could consider?
Yeah, I'm not saying it's irrelevant. Of course, it's relevant, but I don't think that it, again, proves in any way that the leftover pills, which are the ones, are the only pills that the Commonwealth could prove that both Wayne and Roy, their respective pills, had possession of in Spotsylvania, that those were meant for distribution.
The fact that there were multiple unfilled prescriptions for similar types of drugs is not evidence that they were obtaining these drugs for distribution purposes as opposed to for legitimate medical use?
According to the Commonwealth's own expert, no, it is not. He was specifically asked about that, and he said, no, I don't think those are relevant to distribution because they're to be filled at a prior date.
Based on the record, do you agree that the fact finder could draw a reasonable inference that Wayne obtained the car?
No,
Why
I don't.
Not?
Because there's no evidence as to who obtained the car. All you have is that it's not either one of their cars. I don't think it's a reasonable inference that Roy came down from Massachusetts. At some point he did. At some point he was in Massachusetts and got a Massachusetts ID. That could have been 50 years ago. It's not.
But he doesn't have a Virginia one.
He doesn't need to have a Virginia one. He doesn't need to go get a Virginia ID. There's been no proof that he had any reason to ever go get a Virginia ID.
How about the fact that Wayne's driving the car? Doesn't that suggest he's the borrower?
No.
Not even incrementally?
I'm not. Again, these aren't things that I'm saying aren't relevant. Of course, it's relevant to consider, but I don't think that shows that Wayne had to have borrowed the car because he's the one driving it. I think there's a difference between a speculation and an inference. And I think it's speculation that because he's driving it, he must have borrowed it. I think an inference has to be reasonably deduced from the facts that were introduced. All the facts that were introduced are Wayne has a Virginia ID.
But if we take your definition to its logical conclusion, if I'm driving a car down the street, I've got to take it out of the context of your client, I got the car one of three ways. It's either my car, I borrowed it from someone, or I stole it. So why isn't any one of those inferences reasonable?
Because Roy could have borrowed it and then had Wayne drive it.
But that would be an agreement to do something, wouldn't it?
To drive a car in Spotsylvania? Absolutely.
That hurts the conspiracy, though.
No, it doesn't, because then you're saying, I'm saying in Spotsylvania. I'm saying that who knows what happened up in Fairfax, but when Wayne was driving the car in Spotsylvania, I think it's just as reasonable that Roy could have borrowed the car, driven up to Fairfax, come back down to Spotsylvania, or additionally, there's no evidence that Wayne on this day was in Spotsylvania. Maybe he was in Fairfax.
Your time has expired.
I'm sorry, it wasn't counting. Thank you.
We'll come down and